From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Two new polls this week shed light on Californians' biggest concerns, as well as how state government is addressing those challenges. We'll hear what listeners think about the state of the Golden State. Also, we consider the artistic legacy of Plácido Domingo as he's being investigated over his conduct with women. We'll get going right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us today. Hope your day and your week's going well. We have a very busy program today. Later on, we'll talk about the restaurant business. And for those of you that work in that industry, I'm interested to hear how business is doing. We're hearing about significant numbers of closures and I'd like to know just how tight things are in the business. And for those of you perhaps considering opening a restaurant, have you gotten a bit gun-shy about doing so? Later this hour, we consider the artistic legacy of opera star Plácido Domingo. Yesterday, he resigned as general director of LA Opera and canceled his starring appearances with the opera in the coming year. The LA Times classical music critic Mark Swed will join us to talk about Domingo's importance in establishing the city's opera company. Meanwhile, Domingo's the subject of two private investigations into his conduct with women working with and for LA Opera and other organizations. First, two California polls out this week provide some discussion-worthy details about our concerns and views of state government here in California. With me is Mark Baldessari, president and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California. Its survey is just out. And also with us, Mark DiCamillo, who's director of the Berkeley IGS poll, which earlier this week released polls on California's attitudes on a variety of topics. Mark and Mark, good to have both of you with us again on Air Talk. Mark Baldessari, let me start with you, just sort of the general view of Californians about life here, because what we hear from our political leaders is, you know, this is a great time in California, the economy's booming, there's all kinds of innovation taking place here. What do residents say?
Good morning, Larry, and good morning, Mark. With our poll that just came out, when we asked people what's the most important issue facing the state, homelessness was tied with the economy as the top two issues. We've been asking this question for 20 years, and it's the first time that homelessness was even in double digits. So I think as a starting point, people are very concerned about homelessness and the economy. We've seen in our polling this year that there is increasing negativity about the direction of the state and the economy. In this poll, 48% said that they thought that California was going in the wrong direction, and 50% said that they expected bad times in the economy over the next 12 months. So that's, I think those numbers are noteworthy because not only has negativity increased, but we're now, you know, entering a phase in which we're closer to the election year, and these things will certainly impact how people are thinking about everything from presidential candidates to who's going to represent them in the legislature or in Congress, and who is in the best position to lead the country as president.
Does this surprise you, given we've got, 4% unemployment? I mean, it's extraordinary. About as full employment as we've seen. And you've got, you know, the state's coffers are just full of tax revenue. Expenditures on social safety net has dramatically increased in California. School spending is up. Does it surprise you to see the rise in pessimism?
It does. And I think to some degree, this reflects the fact that we live in very troubling times, politically troubling times. Californians are feeling anxious. They were not only feeling anxious about the overall direction of the economy, but Many Californians say that they're worried about how they're going to pay their health care costs. Many Californians said that they're concerned about the possibility of mass shooting in the area in which they live. And many Californians said they were concerned about somebody they know being deported as a result of increased federal immigration enforcement. So there's a sense among some Californians, at least, that things are a bit out of control, and that and that's making them very nervous about the future.
And at the same time, you've got this historically low unemployment. You've got housing costs so high that people, even with decent paying jobs, often can't afford to live close to where they work.
That's right. And housing costs are another issue in our poll that came up very high. Housing costs and immigration were two other issues, as well as the economy and homelessness. So, you know, a sense of things that are just out of control, making people feeling very nervous about their prospects and what the future of life is going to be like in California.
We're talking with the Public Policy Institute of California's president, Mark Baldessari. Their poll is just out, looking at California attitudes on a variety of topics. Also with us, Mark DiCamillo of the Berkeley IGS poll. They've been releasing findings of their poll over the past couple of weeks. So, Mark, let's talk first of all about how this foreboding about the future seems to be factoring in to people considering leaving. You found a significant percentage of Californians considering leaving.
That's right, Larry, and hi, Mark. It's good to be on the show with you. Yeah, one of the findings that we startled me was that when we asked registered voters in the state if they were giving any consideration recently to leaving the state, a majority, 52%, said that they were either giving serious consideration to leaving California or giving some consideration. But if you just focus in on the serious consideration, that's about a quarter of the electorate, and then ask them what the reasons were, the cost of housing by far the number one reason, and it goes up to almost 8 in 10 of the younger people under the age of 40. But it's interesting as well that two other major reasons given had to do with kind of the political situation in California. You have high taxes and also the state's political culture. Those were the number one and two reasons for leaving among conservatives and Republicans. And actually, when you look at who's giving serious consideration to leaving, there's a higher proportion, a much higher proportion of Republicans and conservatives saying they're giving serious consideration to leaving the Democrats. So beyond just the economic component of gripes about California and the difficulties living here, there's a political component as well. At least that's what our survey found.
Yeah. And aside from the loss of political diversity, if those individuals do leave, there's also the issue of demographics. And I wonder if you've got, I think you said 8 in 10 younger Californians considering leaving. These are going to be people who are either just starting families or are in most cases going to be having kids at some point. And if those folks leave the state because they don't think it's affordable to raise their kids here, to purchase property here, that's going to have a serious economic effect on the state down the road.
No question. And I think that's got to be one of the more troubling findings from the poll, is that the young people of California are taking on the biggest burdens, at least economically, in trying to find housing, whether it's renting or trying to buy a house.
Love to hear from AirTalk listeners your thoughts about this poll, and what do you think potentially are the implications of what Californians are saying about our state? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Mark Baldessari, I want to come back to you to see what the PPIC poll says about Californians' attitudes towards state government, because we have a supermajority, of course, of Democrats in the legislature. They've been able to move a host of bills, largely at the behest of labor, which is the biggest influencer now in Sacramento, a governor who's more progressive than his predecessor, Gavin Newsom, than Jerry Brown. Mark Baldessari, what are Californians saying about state government?
Well, we've been in the field six times this year, starting with shortly after Governor Newsom was inaugurated. And state government in our polling has been getting very mixed reviews. I wouldn't say they're bad reviews. I would just say that they're mixed reviews, that when we ask about specific actions that the state government is taking, whether it's how money is being spent or what policies are proposed around housing and poverty and inequality, all of the issues that Californians are very concerned about, you know, those policies have gotten high marks. But overall, you know, mirroring in our polls the just the general malaise that people have about what's going on in the state, amidst the prosperity and the budget surpluses that you described, that the government and that would be the governor and the legislature, and also our elected leaders from Washington, like our two U.S. senators, are getting pretty mixed reviews.
Mark DiCamillo, what does the Berkeley IGS poll say about California's views of government?
Well, we did take a measurement in our last poll on the governor. And our poll, because it's done online, it basically gives voters four options to choose. Either you strongly approve of the governor, you approve somewhat, you disapprove somewhat, or you strongly disapprove. There's no real option for saying I'm undecided or I don't know enough. So we get just about everybody to offer an opinion. And with Gavin Newsom, if in that setting, he actually comes out a little better than what we're seeing in PPIC's poll. And I think a lot of that has to do with just the undecideds in their poll, because most of the people who give Newsom a high mark, and actually 60% of the voters in our poll approved of the governor, 42% of them said they approved somewhat. So I think most of the approval in our poll for the governor is somewhat soft. 39% disapproved, and most of the people who disapproved strongly. So there were strong sentiments on the disapproval side, but fairly mild approval ratings for the governor. So, you know, I don't think our poll is all that different from what PPIC is showing. It's just a different mode of data collection, and we kind of force people into choosing one of the categories. And I think a lot of the people who really aren't that engaged are saying they approve somewhat.
We're talking with Mark Baldessari and Mark DiCamillo, talking with them about their respective polls of California attitudes toward government, what their biggest concerns are, also polling on the presidential candidates. This is where we find from the Berkeley IGS poll, the support for Kamala Harris has just not been there, even in her home state, where the top three nationally are the top three here in California with Biden, Sanders, and Warren. Let's talk with Ignacio in Silver Lake. Ignacio, does this poll sound like it's reflecting your perspective on being a Californian?
I was actually just calling about the comment that I heard a few minutes ago about the rent and how it's putting a lot of burden on just the younger citizens in the city.
Yeah, are you considering leaving?
Yeah, absolutely. We're considering. I've been living in the state for, I'm 37. I've been living here for 30 years. I grew up here. I remember what California used to be like, and I'm considering leaving my entire social and, you know, my social fabric and my network. You know, I have a kid here, and we're just considering leaving because it's too hard.
Where would you go?
Really, we've been looking all over the place. We've been looking up north in Portland. We've been considering moving, you know, just anywhere else where the rent is cheaper. And the thought is, frankly, like, terrifying because this is, my parents are here, all my friends are here, but it's unsustainable. You know, there's nowhere that you can go that's cheap, and then you can still have, you know, like a short commute or a decent commute to work.
So true, Ignacio. I really appreciate your call. And it's funny because Americans have been highly mobile for work for generations. People have moved pretty regularly from the places where they've grown up, where they've had their friends group, where their parents are, have moved to take jobs elsewhere. What we're seeing now is that sort of traditional move for a job to move for affordable housing. So the motivating factor may be somewhat different, but it's that same sort of very difficult decision. Do you leave where you've got your base for the benefits, the financial benefits, career benefits of going elsewhere? You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Anthony in Culver City says, I find the lack of housing in California to be a serious problem. My family's considering leaving the state. Joe in Silver Lake, I live in a house that's paid off and I'm still thinking of leaving because the houses on both sides of me are planning to turn into apartment buildings and I don't want to be squished between them. You can share your comments again on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Mark DiCamillo, Mark Baldessari, gentlemen, thank you both so much for being with us on AirTalk. We'll be back in 1 minute, at which time we'll consider the artistic legacy of Plácido Domingo, who yesterday resigned from his leadership position of LA Opera. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to preview the U.S. Supreme Court cases on the upcoming terms docket. Some very big ones affecting DACA and President Trump's efforts to end the program. Also, look at different employment laws, transgender rights, many important issues that'll play out before the high court. But right now, we turn our attention to tenor Plácido Domingo, who, as Mark Squed writes in the Los Angeles Times, a hugely important cultural figure in Los Angeles, where he championed opera here, has presided as the head of the company for many years, and has been a stellar performer on opera stages around the world and, of course, here in Los Angeles. But the question, of course, is about his artistic legacy at the same time the two private investigations are being carried out regarding allegations of Domingo misconduct with women with whom he's worked. The Associated Press has done a series of stories with a number of women making allegations, a couple of them agreeing to be public about their names and the allegations against him. Joining me is Mark Squed, Los Angeles Times classical music critic. Mark, good to have you with us. First of all, I appreciated the piece that you wrote for the Times. It's very difficult to sort of thread the needle, given the seriousness of the allegations here, with the magnitude of his artistry.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true. And not uncommon with a great many artists.
And let's talk a bit about opera and sort of the culture of opera, because I'm probably not alone in having certain assumptions that you have very big personalities, people who can behave as though they sort of own the world. The diva stereotype comes from the world of opera. Is that reputation earned?
To some degree, it probably is. It almost comes with the territory because the demands on people in opera are so great. The extremes of expression are so great. It has always been, from the very beginning, a highly, highly sexually charged art form, which has also been a huge, has had a huge deal to do with its attraction to the public. So all of these things play out, and I think you will find some of the worst people have been in opera, and some of them have been some of the greatest people. I mean, you can take Wagner as a prime example, one of the greatest figures, not only in opera, but in all of the arts. I mean, you can almost think of no other artist for whom you have an ism. There is Wagnerism. There isn't Picassoism, who's another fairly bad actor. It brings these kinds of personalities. That's absolutely true, which is not to say that Domingo is that kind of personality or isn't.
Yeah, I was speaking more globally than specifically about him.
But it always has been part of the culture, and it is something that is changing, as everything else in our culture is changing. And, you know, what once was no longer is or can be or will be.
Can you speak, Mark, to a bit of the difference in perception, at least as we sit in this point of time, between much of Europe, where Domingo, I believe, still has dates on the calendar to perform, and here in the United States, where Metropolitan Opera for the opener at the last minute, he bowed out there even after performing in the rehearsals there on stage at the Met, the cancellation of upcoming L.A. Opera dates, other scheduled appearances he was making. What is the difference between how this seems to be perceived in European artistic circles versus in the U.S.?
It's exactly the opposite on the two continents. Everything in America has been canceled. Some of the performances were canceled immediately once the AP story ran. Others have taken a while, and as we see, Los Angeles Opera is the last. They had expected to wait for the end of their independent investigation, but in fact, they have now, as of yesterday, Domingo has stepped down and removed himself from his upcoming performance early next year, and he has no more dates in the U.S.
But it would appear his career, at least pending the results of the investigations, will continue in Europe.
His career couldn't be stronger in Europe and probably in Latin America, too. I don't know if he has any engagements in Latin America, but he is accepting, on Saturday, he's accepting a very, very big award in Mexico City.
He grew up in Mexico City after being born in Madrid, right? So he's
Madrid. He grew up in Mexico City. He is a heroic figure in Mexico City. He was very, very, very important in the earthquake relief efforts in the, I think it was it the 1996 earthquake? He's a major, major figure there, and he's getting a very large award, and they have made it clear that he's getting this award on Saturday. And in Europe, it's hard to completely read how they're taking this. In part, it seems to be a European rebuke of the Me Too movement. When I heard him in Salzburg in August, he got an enormous ovation, enormous, 15-minute. The second he walked on stage, there was a standing ovation, and they don't do this in Salzburg. People were begging to get tickets to come in. It was a real show of solidarity. And frankly, he didn't sound very good, and that didn't matter.
Yeah, it was. They were taking a political stand.
Yeah, it was political. Not long after that, Moscow immediately invited him to come and do a recital this month. He has engagements. He has engagements all over Europe in the next few months. And so far, nothing's been canceled.
We're talking with Mark Swed, who's classical music critic for the Los Angeles Times, who wrote a reflection in the Times on the importance of Plácido Domingo to opera in Los Angeles. Of course, he's a global opera star, but here in Los Angeles, particular importance for how he championed opera and the company here in L.A. Mark, speak to that. How did Plácido essentially make his professional base here in Los Angeles with L.A. Opera?
He was involved with Los Angeles Opera from the very beginning. Long before there was Los Angeles Opera, there was something known as the Music Center Opera Association, which didn't produce opera. it just brought in opera, and mainly it brought in New York City opera in the 1970s, where Plácido Domingo was a rising star, and so he became very familiar here very quickly. We saw a lot of him. He made some of his earliest starring roles were at San Diego Opera shortly after that company was formed in the 60s. He was at San Francisco a lot, and San Francisco Opera came down here. He became a regular presence very quickly. He was and he sang with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. He was at the Hollywood Bowl. He toured with Zubin Mehta and the LA Phil. He was a presence, and as he was in much of the world, because his stardom rose very, very, very quickly.
How was his relationship like with major donors to the opera here?
Oh, they love him, and he's a very, very attractive figure in Hollywood, everywhere. He's just a huge celebrity, and he had a great deal to do with the founding of LA Opera, which happened as the result of the Royal Opera coming from Covent Garden to Los Angeles during the 1984 Olympic Arts Festival. That got many local movers and shakers really thinking about that this was the time to have opera in LA, that we needed a company. And Domingo became an advisor and a promoter from the very beginning. He worked with many of the people who founded the company, and he was the star at opening night in their first production of Otello, and became an advisor to the company, a regular performer in the company, and eventually became the head of it. So everything about LA Opera Domingo has been part of it from the very beginning and up to about 2 days ago.
We're talking with Mark Sweat, Los Angeles Times classical music critic. So here you have this central figure in the arts in Los Angeles, beloved by donors and by audiences. But as Jesse writes on our AirTalk page, he says, I'm an opera singer in the Los Angeles area, and Plácido's behavior has always been well known. Mark, had you heard rumors about his behavior with women with whom he worked?
I hadn't. I'd heard about others. I actually hadn't heard about Plácido other than the fact that he was obviously very affectionate towards women. But no, I had not heard that, which doesn't mean a thing. It certainly doesn't mean it wasn't happening.
Yeah, right. No. But I'm just wondering if this had even reached the world of critics.
He wasn't the one that there were rumors about. But that doesn't, like I say, that means nothing. But you did hear about singers, about directors, about people and companies all the time, everywhere, and everything was hearsay. I didn't really know what was going on, but no, he was not. What one heard about Domingo was pretty much the opposite, that everyone I knew who worked with him and that said their job was to keep other women away from him, his fans, essentially, the groupies. He had many, many, many groupies. But his, as to his behavior, I just, I can't speak to it because I didn't hear of it. But like I say, what goes on backstage is not the stuff.
You wouldn't have access to that. Mark, what about the future of LA Opera, given, as you've said, he's been embedded in his identity and LA Operas are so commingled from the very beginning of the organization. How significant a transition is this going to be for the company?
It won't necessarily be that significant, in that it's never been clear exactly what Domingo did. He was the head of the company, but he was necessarily an absentee landlord. He has a huge career all around the world. So the company really was never run by him. He signed off on things. I'm sure he generated ideas and did many other things, but I don't know exactly what they are. He's also been nearing the end of his career, and I don't know how much longer he would have really been staying anyway. So I think the company will just be moving forward, and in the best of all possible worlds, they will take with them what good he brought, and also not take with him, you know, the problems that he may have brought, but also it's kind of time for some new vision. And so I don't see this as necessarily a big problem with the opera company itself, other than Domingo was a cash cow and raised a lot of money, and that will have to be found.
Yeah, they have to find.
Yeah, the place I do see it as a problem with is just his standing in the community, and particularly the fact that he is an icon in the Latin American community, and that has been really important. It has been great to have the head of one of the major institutions in the city be a Spanish speaking person.
Same with Dudamel with the LA Phil.
Dudamel came much later. And then to have both Domingo and Dudamel has meant a great deal. It's been really important that these companies look like the city. And so that's very sad.
Mark, I need to wrap, but I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it very much. Mark Swed, LA Times classical music critic, who has written about the history of Plácido Domingo's involvement with opera in Los Angeles going back decades. And, of course, as the two private investigations into alleged misconduct with women are playing out, continue to follow the story here on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, I want to hear from those of you that work in the restaurant business, restaurateurs, those of you who are servers, managers of restaurants. What do you see going on in your business? Are you concerned that even with the booming economy, times are getting tough for your restaurant, what you're seeing in your business, or not so much a problem? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. One of the things we've heard about California's increasing minimum wage is that it's going to be particularly difficult for restaurants to be able to pay it to their employees with the very small margins of restaurants. Cities like Los Angeles have a higher minimum still. For next year, it rises to $15 an hour. Cities like Pasadena's also pretty much in lockstep with Los Angeles's, although they are going to review what the impact of their incremental increase is. In Pasadena, there have been a spate of restaurant closures just within the past month. For a city the size of Los Angeles to lose 8 well-known restaurants on the heels of losing many others earlier in the year, has the local Chamber of Commerce concerned that something is going on despite the boom in the economy. I'd like to hear from you, wherever your restaurant is located, whether you work as a server, a manager, whether you are someone who owns a restaurant, you're a chef. I'd like to hear from you what you're seeing economically around the restaurants in your community. Have you seen significant numbers of closures? Are you hearing from people in the business that some restaurants are going onto the rocks, or are they withstanding the increase in the minimum wage, finding other ways to be able to compensate employees at a higher level and be able to stay in business? 866-893-KPCC. 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Restaurants have a notoriously thin profit margin where they're typically very susceptible to what goes on in the local economy, the larger economy, employment law, and on a minimum wage. So I'd like to hear from you right now what you're seeing going on. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. One of the interesting things going on in Pasadena, which is per capita one of the most highly restauranted cities in the country, I think it's only San Francisco, I believe, in California per capita has as many restaurants as Pasadena. One of the things that you see is the turnover often is independent of what's going on with the bigger economy. There just seem to be trends where restaurants will a bunch of them will go, and maybe it's more coincidental than anything. And new ones are still opening. 866-893-KPCC. And the chain restaurants seem to be able to weather what's happening in the broader economy a little bit better because of some of the high-performing places balancing out others that are challenged. John in Santa Monica, you're a restaurateur?
We actually had to close our restaurant, Larry, in Hollywood. We lost a significant market share to food trucks, and then there's a need for delivery service, which basically takes our profit out of the equation. So it's a different world out there.
And if you refuse to play ball with the delivery services, that you can't do that?
Well, then they'll just, your customers are going to go somewhere else who offers delivery service.
And is part of that that Hollywood is particularly vulnerable in that just because of large numbers of single people who live there? Or do you think that this is something affecting the broader restaurant business?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, parking is a little tougher in Hollywood, but I do think the younger generation does like to get their food delivered. It's the experience of sitting down in a restaurant is not as important to them.
Okay. So, John, you closed your restaurant. Are you thinking about going back into the restaurant business, or you just feel like it's too tough a business to return to it?
It's too tough. I mean, maybe food truck, but even that is getting so much more competitive from what I understand.
John, what was the name of your restaurant?
Mama Cello's Kitchen.
Mama Cello's Kitchen. All right. John, sorry to hear about that, but thank you for sharing your experience. I appreciate it very much. Now, Jamie in Fullerton works at one of the large chain restaurants. He works at Chili's in Yorba Linda. Jamie, what are you seeing going on there in North Orange County?
Well, our restaurant has been, there's been talks about it closing down for about a year now. So we're kind of just, every day we show up, we're waiting for the chains to be on the door. A couple of other restaurants in Yorba Linda have closed down recently as well. So we're just kind of playing a waiting game at this point.
And what do you feel like it's oversaturation of restaurants? Do you think that the minimum wage has played into it at all? What do you think's going on?
I definitely think the minimum wage has played into it. As a server, we are required to tip out other employees of the restaurant, and that has steadily increased for us. It's going from 4.5% to 6.5% coming up. So we're kind of making up for that difference as servers.
Jamie, I wish you good luck. Hope things are able to turn around there. Jamie at the Chili's in Yorba Linda, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sean in Glendale, I understand you manage a food and beverage company.
So I actually work at a country club, and prior to this, I used to work at a hotel and other restaurants.
Yeah, what are you seeing going on?
Yeah, with the wage increase, there's two things that need to happen, either generating additional business, going out into the community, reaching out to businesses to actually get more business to offset that, or it's passing it on to the consumer itself. So we've had to raise both food and beverage prices to compensate.
And is any of that an education effort with the customers about the higher minimum wage and sort of explaining what's going on with that? Or are customers just without an explanation still coming in?
No, I think it's very, relevant to the customer. They know what's going on, and especially here in Glendale and previously in Beverly Hills. Our wages are a little bit less than even L.A. City. So they know what's going on, but they just, you know, sometimes don't want to open the pocketbook. And that's what's going to take for the business to stay afloat.
Sean, I appreciate your call. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. I'm asking for those of you professionals in the restaurant business to talk about the state of your business, all the challenges in what is a narrow margin business, and what you're seeing going on. This as the minimum wage is set to increase next year in the city of Los Angeles up to $15 an hour. UCRM writes on the page, the cost of $15 an hour to the employer is closer to $20 an hour. The employer has to pay for FICA, SUTA, workers' comp, sick pay, other benefits. If you're an employer, would you pay $20 an hour for someone with minimal skills? This also gives huge incentives for an employer to employ undocumented workers. You can share your comment on the AirTalk page, 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I love checking in with sectors of the economy that are significant. Restaurants certainly are. All of us patronize restaurants, and so many of us have friends or family members who work in the business or who manage or own restaurants. Chance to hearing from those in the business how you're dealing with the ongoing challenges that have always been there in a highly competitive, small margin business, but also with the increase in the minimum wage, how restaurants are coping with that, and whether customers are willing to pay more for their meals to be able to provide the higher minimum wage. Let's talk with Coley in Silver Lake. Coley, thank you for joining us. What's been your role with restaurants?
Hi, I opened and owned two restaurants downtown, one of which is still open, but I sold my shares. But I believe it's still open because it is kind of this destination, a huge restaurant. The other one I had to close because I feel like there started to become way too much competition downtown, especially with a lot of outside restaurateurs coming in, especially from New York, San Francisco, Seattle, where they felt that, you know, the rents were cheaper downtown and it was the next hot thing. So they were blowing out the market. And, you know, we did okay. We did well, but it just kind of wasn't worth it in the end. So I ended up selling that restaurant, selling my shares of the one that's still open, and then pivoting to retail wine.
Wow. What were the restaurant, the one you sold and the other that you ended your partnership in?
The Must is the one that I sold, and Perch is the one that I opened that's still.
Oh, yeah. Perch is a destination restaurant, as you said. So, Coley, you're seeing all these restaurant investors and, I guess, chefs coming from elsewhere, too. Do you feel like in some ways they get more love than the restaurant operators that have been around here?
Well, I think, you know, it's a catch-22. I think, I hate to say this, but in a lot of ways, when it comes to restaurants, people are also kind of sheep. You know, they go where the next hot new thing is. You know, rest in peace, Jonathan Gold, but, you know, whatever he said really was gold. So whether it's a local restaurateur or somebody coming in, you know, sometimes there's a lot of hype. And sometimes they live up to it. You know, you have Major Domo, which was his first restaurant in Los Angeles, and I think it's wonderful. And, you know, he deserves to have, you know, booked out reservations every night. But there's other examples that I won't.
Yeah. Understandably, I wouldn't press you on that. Coley, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Just talking about the further saturation in downtown Los Angeles, you know, how competitive it is. Coley in Silver Lake, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Ted in Echo Park. Ted, what are you seeing in the restaurant biz?
Well, I've opened many, and I have one that's doing well now. What I'm seeing is a real lack in small regular people's ability to open new places, which definitely ties to the minimum wage. Restaurant business is enormously disproportionate as far as the labor cost goes. Your food cost is tied directly to sales, but you cannot understaff your restaurant when you first open. So I'm seeing a lot of investors come in, kind of like the last caller was saying, saturating the market. Those places stay open because they've got millions of dollars behind them. It doesn't matter if they're doing business or not.
Yeah, so they can weather any kind of early establishment problems. What's your restaurant? You have Purgatory Pizza in Boyle Heights, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And, you know, Boyle Heights is one of those areas that, you know, has been discovered in recent years for investment in restaurants. Are you starting to see competition become a challenge in Boyle Heights?
Not really, but the neighborhood I'm in is terrible. We have zero density for retail. I'm in what I call Boyle Flats, and we've been the whipping boy of the neighborhood for a long time. But I do want to say that the city of Los Angeles is considering an administrative beverage use permit that would be a weeks long and hundreds of dollars instead of many, many thousands of dollars and months and many months, if not years long, system to get restaurants a beer and wine or alcohol license, which would really offset a lot of that minimum wage thing if that happened. That'd be an enormous advantage to small businesses trying to make it.
All right, Ted, I appreciate it so much. Let's talk next with Floyd in Costa Mesa. Floyd, I understand you're a server. What are you seeing going on in your business?
Yeah, I work in Venice in L.A., and it's a small restaurant, and there's some sort of, you don't have to go up to the next level of minimum wage being raised if you're under, I think it's 25 employees.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a dollar an hour difference.
Yeah. So the owner of the restaurant keeps it at 25 and under, which means that now we're all doing more work than we used to. Like, you know, shifts where there used to be a busser on, there isn't. So I'm busing my own tables as well as serving. The dishwasher is washing dishes and a fry cook at the same time. So we're working a lot harder. I feel for him in a way because I know he's just doing his best to stay open. And so that's what I'm.
Yeah. What if given a choice, would you take a bit less in hourly wage to have more people on the job at your restaurant?
At times, yes. So
you sound tired by it. I feel for you, Floyd. Yeah, it's got to be hard when you're doing, you know, what you would have had more people to do in the past. Floyd in Costa Mesa with us on Air Talk. William in Pomona said, I think wages aren't going to be as much of a negative as people suspect because it'll lead to better quality of service in restaurants and overall boost for the food industry. William says he's a master chef. And let's see, Nick in Culver City, just real quickly, what are you seeing?
Hi. Yeah, I've seen a very particular business model where the servers have kind of been done away with, and people come to the bar strictly to order food, and it minimizes the, you know, the cost, that the overall cost of paying your servers, where you just go to the bar, you order your food, and then there's a food runner who can also double as a busboy, and if they bring the food out to the table, and they can bust the tables when it's done, but it significantly reduces the cost of paying servers and waitstaff if you have just two or three bartenders on at a time, which you already have in general at a restaurant.
And Nick, I appreciate you sharing that observation. Thank you. And John in West Hollywood says, my favorite restaurant, Café de Trois, just closed in West Hollywood after 35 years. It was an oasis for older gay men. It closed because the wages were too much as they increased for the owner to be able to afford. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I want to thank you. You can post your comments on our Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And let us know what you're seeing going on economically within the restaurant biz. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going great. I was just hearing the announcement about the 20th anniversary at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We're going to be there coming up on November 2nd for our next Film Week screening, and we would love to have you there. It's Blade Runner, The Final Cut. We're going to be talking about the film afterwards with very special guests. We hope you're there. Nothing better than being in that beautiful, historic 1927 theater that was the flagship for the United Artists. And to come out, watch the film together on the big screen in the same year that the film set, you know, Blade Runner set in 2019 L.A. We're going to see it right there near where so many scenes of the film were actually shot and talk about it afterward. Tickets are available. kpcc.org/in-person Saturday night, November 2nd, at the gorgeous Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. I look forward to greeting you there. Well, coming up on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court begins its next term. And as always, there's some very important and fascinating cases that the High Court takes on. And joining us to preview them is Amy Howe, the co-founder of SCOTUS Blog and author of the blog Howe on the Court. Amy, good to have you with us again.
Hey, great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, the New York Times Supreme Court reporter Adam Liptak. Adam, welcome back.
Very nice to be here.
Let's start first with more than one case that are devoted to employee rights for LGBTQ Americans. Amy, why don't you start us off? What's the range of these cases? What are they looking at?
So they're looking at the language of a law that was passed back in 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which it's a federal law that prohibits employment discrimination, and here's the key phrase, because of sex. And there are no federal laws that specifically prohibit discrimination against LGBT employees. And so this is a group of cases, two cases that will be argued together involving discrimination based on sexual orientation, and one involving discrimination based on transgender status. And the Supreme Court's going to decide whether or not this phrase, because of sex, protects LGBT employees.
And Adam, have there been conflicting lower court views interpreting what that means?
Yeah, for the longest time, everybody agreed. The EEOC, lower federal courts, agreed that that language did not extend to sexual orientation and transgender status. But in the past couple of years, important decisions from the federal appeals courts in New York and Chicago went the other way, saying you really can't make these distinctions about discrimination against gay men, lesbians, and transgender individuals without, as a logical matter, taking account of their sex. And that may be the more modern view. So the case boils down to, in a way, do you ask the question of what did people in 1964 think they were doing? Or what does the language, when you look at it fresh today, require you to do? Does the logic of the statutory text require you to protect gay men, lesbians, and transgender individuals? It'll be very interesting to see what the court does with that.
Well, and yeah, and I mean, for the sake of conversation, let's say that they never even considered that issue. That wasn't even part of the equation with the legislators who came up with it. Then is it a matter of the judicial philosophy of the justice, whether he or she thinks of this is sort of an evolving, an ability to sort of broaden the definition as times have changed, or whether it needs to be a much stricter reading of that term in the time it was used.
So that's one way to think about it. Interestingly here, the conservative approach to statutory interpretation, known as textualism, really wants to strip out what people intended at the time and just look at the words themselves. So in the abstract, you might expect the conservative justices to be sympathetic to the LGBTQ arguments. Whether that happens in practice is not clear.
Amy Howe, your thoughts on how the justices are going to come to this?
Well, and there's a really, to follow up on what Adam said, I agree with everything he said. There's a really interesting case from 1998 written by the late Justice Antonin Scalia, who was really at the forefront of the idea that you interpret laws in the Constitution based on the text without looking at what the drafters might have had in mind. And there was a case interpreting this same provision of the civil rights law and involving same-sex sexual harassment of a man on an oil rig by other men. And Justice Scalia wrote in that case, he said, you know, it doesn't really matter what Congress had in mind when they wrote this law back in 1964. And I think we can all agree that they probably didn't have same-sex sexual harassment in mind. But what matters is the text of the statute. So it'll be interesting to see how the justices grapple with that.
All right. We're talking with Amy Howe, the co-founder of SCOTUS blog and author of Howe on the Court, her personal blog, Adam Liptak, Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. We have cases dealing with DACA, the ability of those who came to the United States, brought illegally by their parents at a very young age, to have legal protections here in the U.S. Amy, what are these specific cases looking at regarding DACA?
So there are two issues. You know, the Trump administration announced back in 2017, I believe, that it was going to terminate the DACA program. And there were instantly several challenges around the country. These cases have now bubbled up to the Supreme Court. And as it comes to the Supreme Court, the justices are looking at two different questions. And the first question is whether or not the Trump administration's decision to end the DACA program is the kind of decision that courts can review at all. The Trump administration is arguing that it's not. They say that it's really a discretionary decision, sort of the quintessential kind of decision that the executive branch can make and that courts shouldn't be involved in. The challenger's counterargument is that the Trump administration has said that it decided to end the DACA program because it believed it was an illegal program, that the Obama administration didn't have the authority to create it in the first place. And they said, you can't call it a discretionary decision if you thought it was illegal. That's exactly the kind of decision that courts can review. And so then if the Supreme Court gets past that first step, then they'd be looking at the second question, which is closely related, which is whether or not the decision to end DACA was itself lawful. And here, too, it sort of hinges on whether or not you think the underlying program was legal or not. And the Trump administration said we wanted to terminate it because we thought it was illegal. And also, by the way, they've said since then, we believe that there were other reasons that we thought we should do it, including because courts had struck down related programs or something called DAPA that was for the parents of what the so-called dreamers, the children who've been brought illegally to this country as children and are now young adults. And we wanted to be able to go ahead and wind down the DACA program on our own terms rather than waiting for this challenge that we knew was going to come and have a court tell us that we were going to have to strike it down immediately.
So there are a lot of moving parts for the justices to consider on that.
Exactly. And that the challenger's counterargument is, you know, you only have said that you wanted to terminate it because it was illegal. And in essence, it has to sort of rise or fall on that issue. You can't bring in these other justifications after the fact.
Why? Whenever that case is, we have a decision on those, that's going to require some real study to make our way through those. Also, Adam, I wanted to ask you about the New York gun case. This I recall about guns that would come into New York with its specific gun control laws. What is the issue at play for the justices there?
So New York has, or more strictly speaking, had, and I'll talk about that in a second, an odd little gun ordinance where if you have a so-called premises license to have a gun in your home, you're allowed to take it out of your home to one of a few shooting ranges in the city to practice, but you can't take it anywhere else. You can't take it to your vacation home. You can't take it to gun ranges outside the city, even if it's locked in a box without ammunition, unloaded. And when the court agreed to hear this case after staying out of Second Amendment cases for almost a decade, people thought they're going to strike down this kind of weird little ordinance and in the process maybe give us a lot more information about what the scope of the Second Amendment right established in 2008 in a case called District of Columbia against Heller really means, because the court has been quite silent about the meaning of the Second Amendment after revolutionizing Second Amendment law. New York responds by saying, okay, never mind, we're repealing the law. New York State agrees that the law is repealed. And now the first question for the court is, are they going to hear the case at all, or are they going to dismiss it as moot? If they do hear the case, this ordinance is unlikely to survive scrutiny, and we'll probably learn a lot more about what the Second Amendment does and doesn't allow. All we really know so far is that you're allowed to have a gun in the home for self-defense, but the court hasn't said anything, for instance, about the right to carry guns in public.
All right. Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court reporter, Amy Howe of SCOTUS blog with us. Also, another big case, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. Amy, what's at the center of that?
So this is a case about public funding for religious schools. It involves a tax credit program to provide scholarships for families in Montana who wanted to send their children to religious schools. The Montana Supreme Court struck down the program. They said that it violated a provision of the state constitution that bars aid from going to religious schools. And the families that either received the scholarships or wanted to receive the scholarships said, well, wait a second, you say this violates the state constitution, but we think that violates that striking down the program and not allowing the money to go to religious schools violates the federal constitution's free exercise clause, the guarantee that we'd be able to freely exercise our religion, because you're treating us differently than families who would want to use the money to send our children to secular schools. And so this is an issue that the Supreme Court had dealt with a couple of years ago in the context of a church in Missouri that wanted funding from a government program there to resurface its playground. And the state of Missouri turned the church down. The church took the issue to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, by a vote of 7-2 in that case, said that it did violate the free exercise clause to not give money to the church for the playground resurfacing. But the Supreme Court in that case specifically dropped a footnote that said, we're just talking about playground resurfacing here. We're not talking about money for other religious uses. And so this, in essence, is that case. And so a lot of people are watching this case very closely to see what the Supreme Court is going to say about state support for money for religious schools. You know, could have strong implications for school choice programs.
We're talking with Amy Howe of SCOTUS blog and author of How on the Court, her blog, Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court reporter. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're previewing the Supreme Court term, which begins on Monday, and some of the very important cases to watch there. Adam, let's talk about some of the cases involving the court system. Ramos versus Louisiana, which is due to be heard coming up, I think, on the opening day, involving the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of a unanimous jury, whether that applies to the states. This sounds like a very interesting case. What is the premise for it?
Court would have decided this by now.
Yeah.
They call it 12 angry men, not 10 angry men. But in two states, Louisiana, which recently changed its law, and Oregon, which still has the law, in many kinds of criminal cases, it's enough for a non-unanimous jury, a 10-person majority of a 12-member jury, to convict somebody of, say, murder. The Supreme Court has long held, as you say, that the Sixth Amendment requires a unanimous jury for federal crimes. But it's said that states can do it differently, that we're not going to have the same rule between the federal government and the state government, that's one aspect of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, that does not apply to the states. Almost every other aspect of the Bill of Rights does apply to the states, and I would think that the court would be very sympathetic as a matter of constitutional housekeeping, as it did in the last term in applying the excessive fines clause to the states, also to apply this to the states, particularly because we've got about 1.5 outliers at this point. Oregon and some people in Louisiana, which recently changed its law but did not make it retroactive.
We'll continue our conversation. Adam Liptak, New York Times, Supreme Court reporter. Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog, with us as well. And we're going to continue talking about a big case involving the insanity defense and limitations on that. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. U.S. Supreme Court's next term begins on Monday. A lot of big cases we're talking about with Adam Liptak of the New York Times and Amy Howe of SCOTUS Blog. Amy, let's talk about this Collar versus Kansas case, whether the Constitution allows the state to abolish the insanity defense. I didn't realize there's anything in the Constitution about that.
That's right. It, the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. You know, there's a due process clause to the Constitution. But the question is whether or not the failure to allow someone to raise an insanity defense is part of the Constitution. As far as the Eighth Amendment goes, you know, the ban on cruel and unusual punishment, Collar's argument goes, would be that, you know, you can't convict and punish someone who isn't blameworthy because they don't know what they're doing. You know, this in the same way that the Constitution, the Supreme Court has ruled, doesn't allow states of the federal government to execute someone who's intellectually disabled. It doesn't allow the government to execute someone who's a minor.
And what are the precedents in this area? Have we had conflicting decisions?
You know, there are only a couple of states who actually have the kind of statute that Kansas has. Most states, you know, do offer an insanity defense, but there are a handful of states, including Kansas, who instead of the insanity defense, you know, allow the jury to consider whether or not, simply whether or not the defendant didn't realize that he was, didn't intend to commit the crime. But as long as the defendant intended to commit the crime, he can be convicted of murder, even if he is insane. So yeah, there's the Supreme Court frequently looks at whether or not lower courts have reached different conclusions on a legal issue, but particularly in capital cases, sometimes they will just decide to weigh in.
Another case is Comcast Corporation versus the National Association of African American Owned Media. This involves the claim that a defendant violated federal law barring racial discrimination in contracts, whether it requires the plaintiff to show the defendant wouldn't have turned the plaintiff down were it not for the plaintiff's race. I think this involves, doesn't it, cable networks that are run by Byron Allen, the interviewer and media owner. What can you tell us, Adam, about this case?
That's right. It was brought by Byron Allen, who says that Comcast wouldn't carry some of his programming because of his race. And the question in the case, the legal question, is whether a post-Civil War law that says that African Americans have to be able to make contracts on the same basis as white people requires proof that that was the only reason for the allegedly discriminatory action, or it was one of many reasons? Was it, as lawyers would say, the but-for cause? And that's actually a fairly large and important question that could civil rights groups say really undermine this old law if Byron Allen and people like him were required to prove that was the only reason for the supposedly discriminatory action against them.
And Amy, anything you'd add about the significance of this case?
Now, I think as Adam said, I think that, you know, civil rights groups are watching it very closely. You know, trying to show, because I think their argument would be trying to show that race was really the only factor, like that in this case, Comcast would not have turned down the network owned by Byron Allen were it not for Byron Allen's race, is a lot more difficult to show than the idea that race was just one factor in their decision not to carry channels produced by the network that Byron Allen owns. And so I think that civil rights communities are worried that a ruling for Comcast would set the bar so high that it would shut the courthouse doors to a lot of people, is the argument that they're making.
Adam, I wanted to ask you about a story. This is a case goes back to the Supreme Court in February, blocking a Louisiana law that opponents of the law say through its requirements would allow only a single abortion clinic and doctor to be authorized to provide abortions within Louisiana. You think the court's going to take this up?
I think the court's very likely to take the case, and the February action you mentioned makes it pretty plain that they will. So on an emergency application, the case arrives at the Supreme Court. A Louisiana law is about to go into effect that people say will reduce the number of clinics in the state to one, reduce the number of abortion providing doctors in the state to one. And the court steps in and says, okay, for now, we're going to block that. We're not going to let the law come into effect. Very interesting coalition of justices say that. It's Chief Justice Roberts plus the four liberals. Having said that they're going to block the law for now until the appeal comes to the Supreme Court, I think they're quite likely to take the case. Very hard to conceive they don't. And when they do take the case, it's going to put the Chief Justice and the other justices, but the Chief in particular, in an interesting position, because a few years ago, in an essentially identical law out of Texas, the Chief Justice was in dissent in a closely divided case. So now we're going to see whether the Chief Justice thinks that 2016 precedent in the Texas case will require the Louisiana law to be struck down as well, or whether the differently composed court now, with Justice Kavanaugh replacing the more moderate Justice Kennedy, will come to a different conclusion on very, very similar legal questions and facts.
I want to thank you both so much for talking us through so many cases. I know there are more than we even had time for, but we tried to hit some of the most prominent cases the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up beginning Monday with its new term. My thanks to Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. She also writes Howe on the Court, and Adam Liptak covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the New York Times. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Three years ago, the California legislature passed AB 72. It was designed to stop surprise medical bills for specialty hospital services, the idea being that if you went to an in-network hospital, you wouldn't be blindsided by huge bills from out-of-network physicians. Well, now the House and Senate committees are looking at this and have passed a similar federal plan for this. The question is, would this be good for this to be a national program to try and protect people who are receiving services at a hospital or other provider of specialized health care? Joining us to talk about the effect of the bill here is Lauren Adler. He's Associate Director of the USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy. He's lead author of a new study looking at the effects of the surprise billing law. Lauren Adler, good to have you with us on Air Talk. What do you see as the effects during these first few years?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So as you were saying, so this problem has been bubbling for a while now, surprise at a network billing. So a number of states have acted in recent years, and naturally Congress is looking to state experiences, including here in California, which passed in 2017 what consumer and patient advocates largely consider the most protective law in the U.S., along with Oregon's. Given that California's law isn't as friendly to providers and private equity companies as some other state laws, unsurprisingly, there's been a lot of unsubstantiated claims sort of flying around in this debate. In particular, there's been a lot of hyperbolic claims that the law is somehow causing insurer networks to deteriorate after the law. So we wanted to look into the actual data to help inform the debate here. So with my colleagues, looking into Fair Health Data, which is a national independent database of insurer claims, what we found is that the share of services delivered out of network by each of the affected specialties in California actually declined precipitously by 17% right after the law took effect. And we didn't see near that level of impact for emergency medicine physicians who were not affected by the 2017 law because they were already regulated by a law back from, I think, 2008. So that is right. We've actually seen insurer networks expand for the specialties impacted by California's law since it took effect.
So there had been predictions that specialists who provide these services in a hospital or clinical setting might decline to make themselves available for call panels and the like because the reimbursements wouldn't be sufficient for them. Has that been the case in your research?
So we have not seen that, at least. I mean, obviously, you can find anecdotes of anything, and that's pretty much all of the complaints that have been thrown out there are one-off cases. But the Department of Managed Care in California also looked into this and found that there really have been no changes to access to care concerns, and then they really haven't seen anything like that. And also just, I mean, I'm coming to this from an economist. There's no reason to expect that to happen, which I think the theory here is important. The law is a common-sense patient protection, and it only impacts providers who were profiting off the ability to surprise bill patients before. It should have literally no impact if you weren't profiting off that surprise billing patients beforehand.
But don't physicians, when they sign with particular insurers to be an in-network provider, there are certain, I mean, there are trade-offs involved in that process, right? So if they're going to be compensated at essentially the same level as if they were in-network, don't they potentially miss out on some of the benefits that could accrue from having a deal with a larger number of insurers?
So, right, so they're still, so in California, it basically forces insurance companies to pay at least what the average, say, an anesthesiologist gets paid for the service in question. So, right, the insurer is forced to at least pay the average, so you're, you know, still making your comfortable $500,000 a year salary at a minimum. But you still, an anesthesiologist still works for a hospital that needs them. And right, anesthesiologist needs a hospital to see patient. Hospital needs an anesthesiologist, more than one, in order to serve their patients. The anesthesiologists often are also getting paid directly from the hospital itself. So there's nothing in this law that stops that transaction from happening. So even if there were, they still can get paid even more than that base level if they, you know, are providing quality care that the hospital values.
Love to hear from those of you who work in the healthcare industry, your thoughts about what the effect has been over these 3 years since the implementation of AB 72, which is designed to stop surprise billing for patients who are getting medical services in an in-network facility, only to, in the past, be hit with very large out-of-network charges from the other providers at the facility. We're at 866-893-KPEC. 866-893-5722. I look forward to hearing your thoughts about it if you're in the healthcare industry. Hey, tomorrow on Film Week, our critics review Joker, the controversial new film directed by Todd Phillips and starring Joaquin Phoenix as Batman's nemesis. Also, Lucy in the Sky, Natalie Portman, starring as an astronaut who has a tough time getting grounded to reality after returning to Earth. And Pedro Almodovar's brand new film, Pain and Glory, starring Antonio Banderas and Penelope Cruz. I'm sure looking forward to seeing that as a big fan of Almodovar's films. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. Congress is considering making national the kinds of patient protections that are included in California's AB 72, passed 3 years ago. It's an effort to stop patients from getting hit with surprise medical bills from out-of-network physicians when they're being treated at in-network facilities. We've heard from Lauren Adler, who favors the law and who studied it and says that it's had a generally positive effect for patients, and that it has not proved to be a challenge in having doctors available for patients. Also with us from the California Hospital Association, the organization's president and CEO, Carmela Coyle. Thank you very much, Ms. Coyle, for being with us. What do you see as the effect of the bill over these few years?
Well, I think as we take a look at the effect of the bill in California, the real issue is how this might be translated to what members of Congress are talking about. First and foremost, we fully agree. Patients really have to be protected from unexpected medical bills. When you go to the hospital in particular for emergency care, no one should have to worry about whether they're paying an in-network rate or an out-of-network rate. But the part of the bill that is so problematic, both in California and what they're talking about in Congress, is that we're not only protecting patients, we're also having either the state or the federal government set the rates that insurance companies pay to doctors and hospitals. And that's problematic for three reasons. One, it's protecting the insurance companies, not the patients. It limits what insurance companies have to pay, but there is no guarantee that those savings ever get passed on to consumers. It sweeps the real problem under the rug. The real problem around healthcare spending is that it costs quite a bit to provide the care that we do. Labor, 60% of a hospital's costs, drugs, technologies, and all the rest. We can choose to pay less for that, but it doesn't change the underlying cost. And finally, it's going to hurt patient care. And the concern here is from the hospital perspective, we already have 40% of California's hospitals who are operating at a loss, in the red. If insurance companies are allowed to pay even less, that will mean even more trouble for hospitals and doctors in terms of serving patients.
And again, the price fixing you're talking about, that would be at the federal level. That's not part of this California law.
It is for physicians. So under the bill that the Brookings folks took a look at, that bill set rates for physicians. And unfortunately, what we're finding out now is the rate at which those rates were set are insufficient for many physicians to continue to provide services to people.
Maybe I misunderstood. I thought that that was for out-of-network providers, that in-network, that's still a negotiated rate.
That's correct.
Okay. We're talking with Carmela Coyle, California Hospital Association. Also with us is Dr. Ted Mazur, immediate past president of the California Medical Association. He's a San Diego-based otolaryngologist. Dr. Mazur, thank you for being with us. How has this affected, in your view, the supply of specialists in hospital treatment?
Oh, thank you for having me on here today. And I want to echo some of the things that Carmela just said about the concerns about rates being lowered beyond viability. What we are seeing, despite what Mr. Adler has said in his report and just a few moments ago, is that the complaints here in California to our regulators, the Department of Managed Health Care, about access to care, and specialty care included, have risen 48% since 2016. There are issues with access to care. We're seeing emergency call panels disappearing. One of the hospitals I'm at used to have everyday coverage for my specialty. Now they're begging for people to come in. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that there are no negotiated rates, even in-network. You mentioned negotiations for those who are in-network. That's not the case. These are take-it-or-leave-it contracts. And since the application of AB 72, the take-it-or-leave-it has been, we're going to reduce your contract by 10 to 50%, take it or leave it.
Why would that new state law affect the reimbursements in network?
Because the contracts that were previously negotiated or previously offered had increases over many years. We have anesthesia groups that were contracted for over 20 years at reasonable rates. Medicare has never been a reasonable rate for anesthesia, not my specialty, but certainly aware of them. Those rates were never survivable, and the commercial rates were higher. AB 72 allowed the health plans to reduce those rates significantly by using the Medicare benchmark, and it's much more advantageous and profitable to the health plans to reduce the rates by eliminating the contracts. That is rate setting in California, and it's rate setting essentially for both in-network and out-of-network.
Okay, and let me just... Hold that thought for a moment. I wanted to clarify. So you were mentioning the difficulty having physicians available for call panels to come in to emergency rooms when needed. Has that also been an issue with providing services for elective non-emergency in-hospital care?
Well, that's a great question. So there are a lot of elective services, including consultations in hospitals. And consultations are not covered under the emergency rules. They're covered under things like AB 72. People who used to be able to get a reasonable payment, and I'm with you about profiteering. That's not the goal here for the physicians. Mr. Adler's statements are a little bit off base there. But people who are not contracted were not contracted because they couldn't get a reasonable rate from an insurance company. They could charge something, and then we would hopefully get an arbitration if people didn't like what they were paid. Get the patient out of the middle. We're all for that. But now, with the rates being set by AB 72 for even those elective consultations or elective pathology, you don't control the pathologist, you're there for an elective procedure, we're finding doctors not willing to take those patients on. So while Mr. Adler says the networks, we're seeing decreased out-of-network care, some of that's because the law is forcing consolidation into larger, more expensive groups, which we know drives up the price of health care. And some of that's because physicians are no longer willing to see the patients who are out of network for them because they cannot expect even a reasonable rate of payment, not excessive, but reasonable rate.
Lauren Adler, USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative, you want to respond to that?
Sure. So, I mean, there were a lot of statements thrown out by both of the other folks on the line without any evidence or any data to back them up. So they keep making these claims that payment rates for physicians have somehow, like, just fallen off the roof since the law got enacted in 2017. However, the only data we have shows that anesthesiology payments and radiology payments and pathology payments, those sort of the main specialties affected by the law, have grown about 6% in the last 2 years. That is perfectly in line with historical averages. That is what you expect, and that's what it's better to look at actual data here rather than just to make a bunch of claims. I also think it's worth noting, it's a little bit of absurd, right? The argument here is that somehow when you take away the ability of a doctor to surprise bill patients, that somehow they're going to stop providing care. That is the thing that, oh no, if I can't surprise bill patients for $1,000, I'm not going to work anymore. That is effectively the argument being made here. And I'd like to clarify, I don't think that it is certainly true that most anesthesiologists are not in this and trying to go out of network to harm patients and charge them a lot of money. But there are something like 20% of anesthesiologists in this country who are charging three or four times what the typical in-network anesthesiologist gets paid. And there are a number of large private equity companies operating in this space, including Envision, which is a large company here in California, that very, very explicitly, when they talk to investors, are very explicit that their goal is to threaten and tell the insurance company, I will surprise bill all of your enrollees for thousands of dollars unless you pay me a lot more money to come in network. That is what happens. And I think it also gets lost here. We keep on framing this as insurers versus providers, but it's really patients and employers, I guess, to some degree, versus versus providers and private equity companies here. It is the patients who will see savings if a law that was sort of more aggressive than California's took effect. It looks like the California laws had basically no impact on costs one way or the other. But it is patients at the end of the day who see those costs. There's no evidence that insurers are middlemen, that they take 2% off the top of a very large volume.
Okay.
They do very well on that, but they can't just pocket all of the money.
Let me come back. Carmela Coyle, California Hospital Association, quick response to that, and then I need to wrap.
Sure. I just think that couldn't be further from the truth. I think, well, Mr. Adler has looked at some data. It's not a study, and a lot of things have happened since the law was enacted. What we know in California, there are four insurance companies who control 84% of the market. There's nothing in these bills that requires them to share any savings back with consumers back to the point, this is about patients. We can protect the patients by not charging out-of-network rates and leave to insurance companies and hospitals and doctors the rest of the business discussions to be handled here to ensure that we're not putting a finger on the scale in favor of insurance companies instead of doctors and hospitals who serve patients.
Thank you all for being with us. That's Carmela Coyle of the California Hospital Association. She's the president and CEO. Dr. Ted Mazur is the immediate past president of the California Medical Association. He's San Diego-based otolaryngologist. And Lauren Adler, associate director of the SC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. The Dodgers have had their playoff future sewed up for months. Now they actually get to play the playoff games and see if they can deliver under that higher pressure environment. LA Times baseball columnist Bill Shaken will be with me in 1 minute to preview the series with the Nationals. Back soon. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Bill Shaken is the Los Angeles Times baseball columnist. He's actually on his way to Dodgers Stadium for Game 1 of the National League Divisional Series. The Dodgers with the home field advantage in the best of five series against the Washington Nationals. The Nationals qualified for the divisional series via their victory Tuesday night in the wild card game against the Milwaukee Brewers. Bill Shaken, good to have you with us today. Do we have a final formal decision yet on the Dodgers roster for this series?
Yes, the rosters for the Dodgers and the Nationals have been announced, and there aren't any real surprises. You know, people like to look at the last guy to make the roster, but history tells us it's usually the stars that are the biggest players. And, you know, if the Dodgers aren't going to get quality innings out of Clayton Kershaw and Hyunjin Ryu and Walker Buehler, they may not do so well. And if the Nationals are not going to get quality innings out of their top three starters, Steven Strasburg, Max Scherzer, and Patrick Corbin, who starts tonight, they're probably not going to do very well either.
All right. Well, let's talk about the bullpen, and then we'll talk about position players. For the bullpen, did the two Dodger rookies, Gonsolin and May, did they make the roster?
Dustin May is on the roster. Tony Gonsolin is not.
Oh, I'm surprised. I thought Gonsolin looked pretty good.
Well, he did, and, you know, there's only so many spots you have, and one of the rules in baseball is if you advance in the playoffs, you can always change your roster between rounds. So if the Dodgers are fortunate to beat the Nationals and some of the relievers don't perform the way they hope, then certainly there's a possibility Tony Gonsolin could rejoin the roster.
All right. And who are some of the other players who made it into the bullpen?
Pretty much everybody you'd suspect. You know, Kenley Jansen will be the closer to at least to start the playoffs. Joe Kelly, who pitched so well in relief against the Dodgers last year in the World Series when he was with the Boston Red Sox, he will be there. Pedro Baez will be there. Adam Kolarik, the left-hander the Dodgers picked up at the trade deadline to get out left-handers, he's there. You know, those would be your mainstays. And then the guys who have, of course, come over that used to be starters. Ross Stripling will be the long man. Julio Urias, who can both start and relieve and has done both, probably will be an X factor because he can not only get a lot of hitters out but can provide a lot of innings. He will be there. And, of course, Kenta Maeda, who is in his annual migration from his regular season role as a starter to a postseason role as a reliever.
So it doesn't sound like Floro or Yimi Garcia or Sadler are in the mix there.
Correct.
Okay. Then none of those made the roster. And the order of the rotation, we know Walker Buehler tonight is the starter. Is it presumed Clayton Kershaw goes tomorrow?
I hate to presume anything as far as the Dodgers go because they don't really much care about tradition, they care more about gamesmanship. So do we know who's pitching tomorrow for the Dodgers? No, we'll probably find out in about an hour or so.
Okay. And then with the positional players, we have rookies this year who were standouts. Will Smith took over the starting catcher job. Matt Beatty saw considerable time as a utility player. Gavin Lux only came up when rosters were expanded in October and played a lot of second base. Did those rookies all make the roster?
They did, yes.
Okay. And what about some of the older guys, David Freese, Jed Jerko? Did they make the roster?
David Freese did. He will be playing first base, I would imagine, tonight with the Nationals starting left-handed pitcher and Patrick Corbin. And most likely that would mean Max Muncy at second base. And then when the Nationals go to the right-handed starters in Strasburg and Scherzer, I think that's when you'll see Gavin Lux at second base.
All right. So, wow. From his debut in the major leagues just a few weeks ago to starting in the National League Divisional Series. Bill Shaken, Los Angeles Times, a baseball reporter and columnist with us. So, Bill, what is the biggest challenge for the Dodgers in this series, albeit them being the favorites?
It's basically starting pitching. You know, this is an era where teams are building with the bullpen. They don't ask their starting pitchers to go very long. You know, there are probably longtime Dodger fans who grew up watching Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale, and if they didn't throw a complete game, it was a bad outing. And even Clayton Kershaw, you know, seven innings is considered a minimum for him. But a lot of guys now go five innings, and the teams figure out how to patch it together from there. The Dodgers and the Nationals especially are old school. The Nationals spent $140 million last year, more than any pitcher got in free agency, to sign Patrick Corbin, the guy who starts tonight. And the Nationals are run by a guy named Mike Rizzo, who is not one of the Wall Street guys that runs most clubs. He's an old school baseball scout, player development guy, and he believes your best chance to win is to get six or seven innings from your starting pitcher. And as we talked about, Scherzer, Strasburg, and Corbin might be the best top three of any of the playoff teams in the National League, certainly match up well with the Dodgers, and that probably is the Nationals' best chance to win, because if the Dodgers can get those guys out and get into the Nationals' bullpen, that's where the Dodgers have a huge advantage.
Bill, thanks so much. Know you're on the way to the stadium. Thanks for taking time with us. We appreciate it.
All right, take care.
Bill Shaken, Los Angeles Times baseball writer. The game at Dodger Stadium tonight starts at 5:37 with first pitch. It'll be televised on TBS nationally. It's a best of five series, so tonight at 5:30. Tomorrow, it'll be a 6:30 start, also at Dodger Stadium. They're off on Saturday, and then the series continues with a Sunday game in D.C. Thanks so much for joining us for Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Her guests will be the authors of the new book, Border Wars, Julia Hirschfeld and Michael Shear of the New York Times, all about President Trump and his border policy. Also want to remind you, Film Week tomorrow here on 89.3 at 11 o'clock. Our critics review the controversial new film Joker, Batman's nemesis played by Joaquin Phoenix. Todd Phillips directs. Lucy in the Sky, starring Natalie Portman as an astronaut. And Pain and Glory from director Pedro Almodovar, starring Antonio Banderas and Penelope Cruz. Have a great afternoon. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk here on KPCC.